Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people.
And the Media Project is back for another week. Nice to have you with us. Glad you could join us. I'm Ira Fussfeld. I'm just about to tell the folks, don't they recognize my voice by now?
You don't look like Rex.
No, I'm a little bit shorter.
Taller and thinner.
And he has a little bit more hair than I do, and I have a little more other stuff that he doesn't have. But at any rate, I'm Ira Fussfeld, as I was saying before I was immediately rudely interrupted by Alan Shartok. I'm from the Daily Freeman of Kingston, New York. Alan Shartok is the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, among other things. And Judy Patrick is with us, the editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady. Nice to see you.
Always glad to be here.
Are you going to help me this morning?
I will try.
Okay, or this evening or this afternoon, depending on where around this country people are hearing the program.
And by the way, I looked at the list the other day. There's like 40 stations that play this thing. I can't believe it. I'm going to bring in the whole list.
I would love to see the list.
Where they are.
Yes, because that's...
I just have the call letters. But next week, I'll have the places like Nacogdoches, Texas, or whatever.
And without sounding derogatory about our fine efforts, what does it say about us that these other stations around the country are playing us? Does it say more about us or about them?
Well, the 2,000-year-old man said at the end of the record, we're here and they're not.
That's right. Well, here, let's start with a test. How many of you know the definition of this word, which I just learned this week? And the word is twibble. Do you know what twibble is?
Yeah, Elmer Fudd saying the word tribal.
Judy, you want to take...
I know you do your homework, so you can explain it. And so I can understand this. This is when a tweet is potentially libelous.
Well, it's very interesting. And a tweet obviously meaning something that's been posted on Twitter. And one of the things we've been talking about here for a long time is about the level of discourse on the internet and how it seems for the time being that there really is no case law that has been established vis-a-vis what we in the press have ordinarily called libel or in broadcast would call slander.
Mm.
And now we have a case, although I'm told there have been several, this one may be the defining case. And this is, believe it or not, Courtney Love, the entertainer, is being sued by a law firm, which does not sound like good news for her, but she's being sued because she accused her former attorney of bribery in a tweet. And if you've seen Courtney Love, you know and would not be surprised that it was a predictably colorful tweet and used a four-letter word. And she's being sued for defaming her, or the law firm, rather. Should that make us happy that there may be a test of the law versus Twitter? Or should we, who frequently tweet, say, boy, we'd rather the court stay out of this?
You know, I'm surprised there haven't been more cases like this because the Twitter world can be outrageous in terms of what is said. There's not a lot of thought that goes into some of these tweets, and they can be pretty harsh and derogatory.
And as long as they think that you can do anything you want, they're going to do it. I mean, there are some really insane people out there. And I have to tell you that I object a great deal when I read some of the stuff that is written, particularly about me. And I'm just kidding, of course.
Is that hashtag Shartok?
Yeah, but there are some people out there who just slander and libel with impunity. They make stuff up. You know, people want a free internet, but the only thing I think that is eventually going to happen is that some of these idiots are going to get after federal judges and others. And then we'll see some changes in the law.
Well, there's no question that if Twitter is considered the digital version of the printed word, one of many, that if you do what you do in print, which is to say libel someone, if you do that on Twitter, logic would say you should be following the same legal guidelines. The question that needs to be defined is, is the digital world different? Is social media social, as we would just describe it, a couple of us standing around talking socially? And if I say to Judy around the water cooler, I suspect Alan Chartok bribed somebody. You wouldn't sue me for that necessarily because we're just talking among ourselves. Well, but if we put it on the radio or put it on newspaper, you could sue us for that.
Well, yeah. I mean, it takes a lot to sue somebody. We all talk about it a lot. But, you know, you better have enough money to pay a lawyer and pay a law firm and do all of those things. I think that every time we talk on this program about why newspapers aren't as good as they used to be, somebody, probably you, Ira, says, well, we got all the social media out there, and that's compensating for a lot of things that you would ordinarily read in the newspaper. So now, hey, if we're going to have the standard for newspapers, and these are the new newspapers, then I think I've always believed that these people have to be reined in. By the way, I don't think there are that many of them. In other words, there are a lot of people who do Twitter, and there are a lot of people who do Facebook. But most people are very decent, great people. But there's always a handful, maybe 1% or 2%, who are really nuts. And those are the people who really have to know that if they do something that's hurtful and hurts somebody economically or with their family or something, they should be punished.
You know, but the great thing about Twitter is you get this free flow of information. And one of the concerns about imposing libel law on tweets is that it will suppress a really good conversation and it will suppress the free flow. I think standards are really important, but we also have to recognize that this is an important developing medium.
Well, I was going to ask you, because as I'm sitting here, I would lean towards being favorably disposed if the libel law was somehow applied to Twitter, because it is simply a different form of what we do in print, and that the standards that we newspaper people have had to uphold all those years have not constrained us, I don't believe, to a degree where we don't feel we can't get our points across. But there is.
But you don't lie.
Right.
And a lot of these people lie and know they're lying.
But I think Courtney Love's tweet was her opinion, is what
that is
arguing.
What she is claiming, yes. And similarly, if we write editorials that contain objectionable material, but they're labeled opinion, it would make it much harder, if not impossible, to create a successful lawsuit.
Except, Ira, that there are always consequences. I mean, to me, the whole idea of torts or hurting somebody is whether or not you can prove that if you're a lawyer and a famous star said you're a thief, you know, are you in fact entitled to sue?
Well, what's interesting about this case is that it's the celebrity who is the one making the allegation against a law firm. Typically, the celebrity is the one claiming to have been libeled and will not be successful because celebrities and others who are public figures have an even higher standard to clear.
Not a higher standard, Ira. Let's be fair about it. An almost impossible standard. Well, if you've put yourself forward into the public discourse, and somebody writes and says, Chartok robbed a bank. That's bad. That's not right.
And we're kicking your reputation all over the place this morning. First you bribe somebody, now you've robbed a bank.
Can he sue the radio station?
I think he can sue himself.
No, but I'm suing both of you.
That could be painful. Well, anyway, this case, we'll be following it. It's called Gordon and Holmes versus Love, and it's going to be heard in California, Los Angeles Superior Court. And some experts are saying it may rival the New York Times versus Sullivan case, which is a famous case that really separated free speech from protecting a person's reputation.
So direction, if I may add.
And that wasn't Ed Sullivan either.
But I'm telling you now that I can see the New York POST headline. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Judge rules against Love.
Or if it's appealed, she succeeds, then it could be Free Love.
Free Love.
Yes, no, that's a 60s reference for those who are too young to remember.
Yeah, I remember it well.
All right, Edward Snowden, we know him, we've spoken of him. He is the former National Security Agency contractor who leaked all those secret documents regarding government spying and is now in exile in Russia. He is joining the board of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, which was co-founded by Daniel Ellsberg, whom we all know or most remember is the guy who leaked the Pentagon Papers
Indeed.
A generation ago.
And is a somewhat of a hero amongst Americans.
Exactly. And whereas Snowden, at least right now, although there is a sense that it's changing, Snowden has not been a hero. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't remember, maybe you guys do, was there a break between when Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers and then to when he became more or less a revered figure, or was he in Snowden's shoes initially?
Oh, I think there was some of that.
Oh, I think there was, yes.
But on the other hand, remember who he had going for him? He had the New York Times and the Washington Post going for him, and that does a lot to put the stamp of legitimacy on you.
As opposed to Snowden, who seemed to be a free agent or was affiliated with WikiLeaks and the fellow Glenn Grunberg.
Assange,
Grunwald. So anyway, he is now joining the board of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Does the fact that Ellsberg is giving him his imprimatur mean that it's going to further push Snowden into the more favorable light of the average American?
Well, let's face it. I hear from people on the Snowden affair all the time, and if they're coming predictably from the left, they're going to be in favor of basically more information so that we don't get into a dictatorship situation. Some come from the far right and saying he's disloyal, he's a traitor, he endangered our people around the world, although that's unclear. That's also predictable, but there are also libertarians from the right who are saying, you know, we can't have the NSA, the National Security Administration, and others keeping us under surveillance and the rest. So it's getting a little interesting to watch where the coalition in favor of Snowden is. In other words, some from the left, some now from the libertarian right.
And you are seeing that shift towards Snowden in large part because Americans are seeing what kind of information the National Security Administration was releasing or watching about them, that they were intruding on their personal lives. And so the average American is saying, oh, maybe that was a good thing that we know that, and we wouldn't have known it if Edward Snowden hadn't leaked those documents.
The foundation says that its mission is for news organizations to publish government secrets in the public interest and for brave whistleblowers to come forward, even though it's personally very risky. And it says that Snowden embodies exactly what we, this organization, started the organization for. So they believe that they are in safe ground in including him among their numbers.
Well, one could make the case, all right. I don't think there's any question. I've said it 10,000 times to the point where people are yelling for the basin every time I say it. Hasten, Jason, bring the basin. But I happen to think you can't have a democracy without freedom of information.
Yeah.
And it turns out, when you read the Assange stuff, when you read the WikiLeaks, when you read that this country is being run on two levels. One is the press releases that get given out, and the other is what's really happening. So how do we make an intelligent judgment as citizens if we don't know?
Yeah, I just think that Snowden, who may now, under the definition that the foundation describes, probably fits well in that definition. I think that he is still, as you pointed out earlier, regarding how Ellsberg had the New York Times and the Washington Post, Snowden was viewed negatively, I think, by a lot of people because he was employed by the NSA in a freelance position or an independent contractor position and took that material and released it. And it just it rang the wrong way to some people.
But Ari, if I may, and I always respectfully, I just want you to know that I think that part of the thing is that we have had a sea change in the way in which we are looking at these guys. When Ellsberg did it, what did we have? We had what was left of the Soviet Union. We had, you know, so it was regarded as different. But when you take a look now, yeah, you get the National Security Agency, you get the various acts that have been passed in order to, quote, protect the population. It's a different time. We had Joe McCarthy back there in the 50s, and he was talking about what? He was talking about the communist menace and the rest. But this is different because now the NSA is coming along and saying we don't have a single geographic entity against us. What we have is all these people, anybody can blow anything up, and we've got to check everybody's mail, and we got to check everybody's phones, and anybody who makes a phone call overseas, we got to know about it. So it's a different context now.
And let's not forget the important role the press plays when someone leaks something, because the press checks things out, puts it in context, and makes sure that some of the information that leak isn't going to harm the troops or harm national security. So the press has that check on it. I think Snowden might have released all the documents online himself, but he did do the right thing in my mind and give it to the press, and they vetted it.
This is The Media Project. I'm Ira Fussfeld with Judy Patrick and Alan Shartok. And just to show you, as what Alan was talking about with the Soviet Union and et cetera in the Ellsberg days, and the more things change, the more they stay the same. Here we are on the eve of the Olympics coming to Russia, and Russia has expelled a United States journalist. He has been banned from Russia. Apparently, they feel he is a spy. He is an undesirable. And I'm not sure what to think about it, particularly in terms of a public relations decision right on the heels of the world the free world coming into Russia. Is this what we want to see from our friends in Russia, right?
Well, friends, of course, has quotation marks around it.
It did.
Yeah, I know. And there are a number of things you've just raised. Are journalists ever spies? You bet. The first thing is you bet. So maybe the guy was a spy. I don't know. All I know is what they say. But Putin, of course, is becoming more and more heavily towards the dictatorship part of the Russian history. In other words, you may call them different things. You may call them Stalin. You may call him Frederick the Great. But in the end, this is a guy who is running this country and putting people in jail who he doesn't like and the rest of it. So you can look at it that way. So anything's possible.
Well, it's the first time that Russia has done something like this since 1991. And so it's over 20 years. And they are claiming...
Seems like yesterday.
They are claiming that this journalist, David Satter, S-A-T-T-E-R, infringed immigration rules. A flagrant violation, and has now been barred from the country for 5 years.
And this Satter was working on stories that were highly critical of Putin and investigating some pretty atrocious things that has been alleged that Putin did.
So the question is, why didn't this guy wait until after the Olympics, was his calculation that this is the message I want to send as the journalists from around the world descend upon my country?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, what you just said. And maybe he dated too many women.
Putin or...
No, the Satyr.
Oh, Satyr. Why is this Satyr different than all other Satyrs?
Gotcha.
That's a whole other different story.
It.
We talked a little bit last week about Howard Kurtz. His name came up.
Oh, boy.
I can't remember his name came up.
I got clobbered on this show because I said, you know, I got reservations about this guy.
Well, and I as well was saying how his move from...
But I've been justified. Vengeance is
well,
mine.
Well, we don't know. For the listeners who haven't heard, I'll tell you what happened. Howard Kurtz, for many years, the media critic for the Washington Post, and I think it's fair to say very well-regarded around the country.
Yeah. And what circumstances did he leave the Post?
He then became, at the same time he was at the Post, he went with CNN.
Yeah.
And then he moved on to an opportunity at the Daily Beast, which I believe was run by Tina Brown.
Yeah.
And he was given more responsibility and presumably more money at the Daily Beast, as well as whatever he was doing at CNN, which is primarily a weekly program on Sunday. He then, many believe, became sloppy because he had too much going on. He's a chronic tweeter. He was a blogger, was doing all sorts of stuff, and got sloppy and made some mistakes. He disassociated himself, or vice versa, from the Daily Beast.
Mm.
Ultimately moved from CNN to Fox News, but in the interim...
That's what I really have a problem with.
But in the interim, he became associated with a site called The Daily Download, which was also heavily run by a journalist by the name of Lauren Ashburn. Lauren Ashburn frequently appeared with Kurtz on his old program on CNN, did any number of videos with her on the Daily Download. But the point is, Kurtz denied throughout all of this that he had a managerial role in the Daily Download. He said he was paid only as a freelancer, had no role with the parent company. And now the Gawker website is saying that Kurtz was, I believe the number is $100,000 involved with the Daily Download.
That he had invested
in the Daily Download, and also had seemingly really put his imprimatur on Lauren Ashburn, whom he still uses now on his new program. I don't know if you've seen his new program on Fox.
Are you kidding? As a social protest, I would not turn that, unless I'm making a mistake.
Well, I commend
that.
You to watch it.
You can't make me watch somebody who's been more violative, in my opinion, of free press than anybody. I mean,
well,
they're owned and operated by Murdoch.
Oh, Murdoch.
They come on and their intonations are predictable every single time. And unlike you, Ira, I'm not willing to say that's fair journalism.
So I'm the one with the open mind.
No, I don't think so, Ira. I'll be honest with you. I think I'm the one with the open mind, but I'm going to go to places, even if I don't like them, that I feel have... more integrity. CNN has a lot more integrity than, in my opinion.
Well, the integrity part speaks to this Kurtz issue, because after all of that lead-in, the average listener may be saying, what's the big deal if he invested money in the Daily Download? And the big deal would be that he is denied having any interest of that sort in the Daily Download. And
it's always the cover-up that gets them.
And it's a media ethics issue, which he's always talking about, lying in the media he's always talking about. And why, as some gawker person say, why would anybody want to lie about this? He's allowed to do it. It's a small potatoes issue.
Right. What do you think,
right,
Judy?
If true, I hate to sound like a mother, but I'm really disappointed.
In Howard Kurtz.
If you did that, Timmy, I'm really disappointed.
Very
in
hypocritical.
You.
I mean, I think that a lot of people in the industry look to him to be a strong advocate for media ethics. And if he's done this, this is contrary to everything we stand for. Not everything we stand for, but a lot of what we stand for.
Good for you, Judy. I'm very proud of you.
Yeah, I agree. It's very, you know, Kurtz, as I said, when going back to his pre-CNN and solely Washington Post days, I think had rightfully achieved a level of respect in the industry that he was a straight shooter. He was willing to be critical or not critical across the board. And now it just looks like he's another one of those guys who's jumped into the pile.
Yeah, and we're looking for someone to replace him. I mean, I think we need people talking about these issues all the time. There's the Media Project, of course, but
After that, very little. But I want to ask you guys a question, a personal question, because I know Ira prepares for this thing. And he has a long
I was actually going to go off script.
Long list of things he wants to do. But I want your advice on something. When you get a letter from a liar who says you said something you never said or who makes stuff up, what's the proper answer for an editor to write back? My preferred thing is sometimes to write back and say, no, that's not true. And then they inevitably write another lie in which, you know, I say, OK, I don't deal with liars and therefore I'm not going to be talking to you anymore. Or I just circumvent the whole thing and say, thank you. Thank you. Now, that infuriates them because they think they're going to get you involved, you know, in one of these fights that goes on forever. But if you just say thank you, I just got a letter from a guy who said, thank you. How dare you say thank you? So do you have any advice for me?
Now, do you ignore some of the criticism that you and will inevitably get?
Right. No, I don't ignore it. I always respond to it. And I want to set the record straight. And I say, that's not true. This is.
Yeah, I say that.
I don't say it's a lie. I say it's not true. And if I
What's the difference between not true and lie when you see a vituperative, mean-spirited
but
letter?
So you say this is not true and you try to state the facts as clearly as you can and thank them for writing. But if they write again, I don't get into a back
and forth. That's right. No second chance.
And does it make a difference to you whether the letter is email or snail mail?
Not anymore. It used to, but not anymore. Does
how
it
so?
Because, well, email is actually a lot faster to respond to, but I do still like to write snail mail, but I don't get many snail mail letters.
Oh, because I meant it in the sense, do you take snail mail more seriously because somebody actually sat down and took the time to write a letter and put a stamp on it?
I'm with Judy. I don't anymore. A lie is a lie, I always say.
Well, I feel like it's important if someone misstates something I said, either willfully or just ignorantly, I feel it's important that I write them back and say, no, that's not what I said.
Okay, so you did that. Judy agrees. I actually agree with that.
Yeah.
If I find that the original letter is so violative and so vile of the truth, sometimes I'll just write thank you to the letter because I think that's what they're looking for. They're looking for engagement, and the one thing I'm not going to do is give it to them.
Yeah, and I also will usually not engage someone who is a chronic complainer because it's clear that you're not going to change their mind.
But often what you'll find when you get a person who's complaining on the phone, they really don't want to have a conversation. They just want to talk.
Now, what about at your place, do you handle the letters to the editor or you have someone do that?
Someone does that.
Someone does it. When there is a letter to the editor critical of the Gazette, how often do you guys do an editor's note, in effect, responding to that complaint?
If it's right, we will do it, especially if it clarifies an issue. We do like to run letters that are critical of us, especially if they're current. We don't like to just run anything like your paper sucks.
Yeah.
But if it's a real issue, we will run that letter.
Because there was, for a time, prevailing wisdom, at least that I heard in the business, just let the letter run without any editor's note because readers would feel like we got the last word and we were taking advantage of having the last word and we were discouraging people from writing into criticism.
Too bad. Why would you want to support a liar?
Well, again, we're not necessarily talking about lying. It's if we think you guys did a bad job in covering this story and here's
why. Okay, that's
why.
Fair. Sure.
Well, but maybe if the reason is three of our reporters called in sick today and this happened or we had four
Stop whining.
Okay, but that, so if we wrote that, then the reader response would be, we don't care what your problems is, they're your problems?
Yeah, you didn't cover my daughter's basketball game.
Well, if you want to write That's about what anything you heard about today and take a chance as to whether we will ridicule you here next week, the address is media@wamc.org. And we've just about run out of time, so we thank you for joining us on The Media Project. I'm Ira Fussfeld with Judy Patrick and Alan Shartok, and some variety of three of us will be here next week.
And next week, you'll probably, if you're here, you'll probably be able to bring up that subject, which you didn't bring up because I had another subject to bring up.
Excellent. I won't moderate next week, and you can talk about anything you want.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Now you remember.